From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Jim Keys spent the first half of this decade as the CEO of 7-Eleven stores. Now he's applying the lessons of the big gulp to the small screen as head of the troubled video giant, Blockbuster. Plus, critic Ben Fritz asks, why are hardcore gamers so hard-hearted? And good agentry with writer and producer Rob Long. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. The music world was rocked by news last week that Apple's iTunes might just be considering a change from a la carte to an all-you-can-hear model. iPods would cost more, rumors are anywhere from $20 to $100 more, but you could listen to all the music you wanted at no additional cost. The Financial Times says it's true, Apple won't comment, and the record companies poo-pooed it. But if the deal does make, it would change everything. Think about it. Every song available on iTunes, more or less, free. There's a lot of negotiating that would precede such a deal, but if the labels are even considering Apple's entreaties, it would be an about-face in their sour attitude towards Apple. In other Apple-related news, blogger Nikki Fink noted the company's apology last week to iTunes season pass holders. Their subscriptions were shrunk by the recent writer's strike. If the season does end up with fewer episodes of your favorite show, Apple promises you you'll receive a partial refund to make up the difference. Now, that could be an expensive precedent, since the way things are going with Hollywood labor, there might be another strike in the near future. After all, it took the AFL-CIO to keep the Screen Actors Guild from going to war, not with producers, but with its sister union, AFTRA. Last week, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney announced that after weeks of internecine bickering, the two actors' guilds are finally committed to negotiating jointly. Quote Sweeney, "I congratulate the two unions for reaching agreement on this important matter and look forward to productive joint negotiations." Congratulate? We'll congratulate them when they successfully negotiate a new contract, not for averting a civil war. Ay, Chihuahua. And finally, speaking of Chihuahuas, in one of the oddest movie promotions in a dog's age, the Walt Disney Company is partnering with the Catholic Church for its new film, Beverly Hills Chihuahua. On March 22nd, Disney held the Blessing of the Chihuahuas, a procession in downtown L.A. where your little pooch could hobnob with celebrity Chihuahuas from the film and receive a personal blessing by Cardinal Roger Mahoney. Those who brought their Chihuahua to the Beverly Hills Chihuahua booth got a free Chihuahua-sized t-shirt and all their Chihuahua sins forgiven. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, can the king of Slurpees save Blockbuster? But next, worst video game review ever. Video gaming grew 43% last year to become an almost $18 billion industry. You can bet that gaming will continue to be a hot topic on this program. Luckily, we don't actually review video games for a living, like Variety's Ben Fritz, who has suffered the slings and arrows of outraged gamers. Note that the emails and blog entries in the following piece are real. Alas, because this is radio, we couldn't quite capture the unique spelling and grammar in much of the correspondence.
What an absolutely horrid little d**t for brains this reviewer is.
You're a failure at your job.
You're an idiot.
Welcome to my inbox, circa last November. It was just a few days after Daily Variety ran my review of Super Mario Galaxy, Nintendo's latest addition to its 20-year-old video game franchise, about a portly little plumber whose girlfriend keeps getting kidnapped by a talking dragon. I had been reviewing video games for Variety for about a year, and while I'd gotten my share of flack, none of it seemed particularly worse than what the paper's movie and TV critics face. Then, I published my review of Super Mario Galaxy. I praised the game's astoundingly original level design, but I wasn't too impressed with the story or the graphics. Plus, it seemed like they tacked on some pointless features to make use of the motion-sensing abilities of Nintendo's uber-popular Wii console. Almost immediately, I was under attack via literally hundreds of emails, blog posts, and website comments.
Any editor at Variety reading this please dispose of this ghastly little creature's services before he makes more of a mockery of your website.
One anti-Ben Fritz story became the second most popular headline on the social news site Dig.com after garnering more than 1,600 votes. That was bad, but then the Mario fanatics noticed an ad for Nintendo competitor Sony on Variety's website.
This probably is the most obviously paid-off sponsored by Sony piece of tripe I've ever had the displeasure of reading.
Variety is nothing but an anti-Nintendo hate-monger that's getting paid by Sony to write these crap reviews.
You might want to know that it's spreading around the important places on the internet where people understand bias, sponsorship, and weak journalism.
You gave Mario Galaxy a bad review. How about you check the real game critics like IGN and GameSpot and all those, read their review, then read yours. Next time, let a real critic review games on Wii, not some Sony-bribed guy.
To a certain extent, of course, this is just the internet at work. Chris Kohler, editor of the video game section for Wired.com, notes that many game fans spend a lot of time talking to each other online.
When people pick up on something on the internet now, they know how to get a reaction out of it. They can get thousands of people coming in and piling on you.
If that were the full explanation, though, every kind of critic would occasionally experience this kind of vitriol. But they don't. Joe Morgenstern has been a film critic for the Wall Street Journal for more than a decade.
And what I love about this job is that I get lots of just conversational emails. There is, for the most part, a collegiality in the emails I get that I really enjoy.
So what makes gamers so passionate, so cynical, so angry? Well, one condescending view is that they don't have much else going on in their lives. Another theory is that they're threatened by their hobby going mainstream. Millions of new people are becoming video game players thanks to what are known as casual games, like Guitar Hero and Wii Sports. Observers like Chris Kohler of Wired.com think some hardcore players are having a tough time adjusting.
Gamers identify as being gamers, and suddenly something that was just for them, now they see grandmothers playing video games, and they get really upset.
For those people, he adds, the worst thing you can do is criticize their favorite brand, like Nintendo. It's akin to telling a bunch of 12-year-olds that Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling is a hack. So does that mean that whenever I write an unpopular and possibly wrong-headed review, I'm doomed to an avalanche of self-esteem-killing emails encouraging me to
drop your position as a reviewer and a human being?
Perhaps. But eventually, I'm betting that video game critics will start getting some respect. As more outlets outside of gamer magazines and websites start covering video games, our work could become more respectable. Then my experience might be a little bit more like Joe Morgenstern's.
I never imagined for a moment that I'm rendering any ultimate truth about the goodness or badness of movies. I love the idea of just provoking a dialogue, and email has really enhanced that feeling for me.
I won't hold my breath for a video game critic to be awarded the Pulitzer Prize. I don't even think gamers are going to lighten up on me anytime soon. For now, I'll just have to settle for small kindnesses. Like the guy who eviscerated me in an email, but then added,
sorry if I offended you in any way.
For the business, I'm a horrid little t- for brains. I mean, I'm Ben Fritz.
Ben Fritz is video game reviewer and tech reporter for Variety. He also produces allegedly funny videos for Comedy.com. It seems like a very bad time to run a chain of video stores. DVD sales were down last year for the first time since the invention of DVDs, and Netflix has taken a sizable chunk of the rental business. Digital downloads are the wave of the very near future, even though discs may live longer now that high-def DVD is going Blu-ray all the way. Video rental giant Blockbuster tried to adapt to all this, but sank into pools of red ink. Its stock, which hovered around $20 a share at the end of 2003, plunged to about $3. Shareholders, led by corporate raider Carl Icahn, howled for the head of CEO John Antioco. And last July, they got their wish. They've seemed to have chosen a replacement wisely. To quote the New York Times, if Blockbuster is a company in desperate need of a script doctor, the man it has chosen for the task, James W. Keyes, the former chief executive of 7-Eleven, could perhaps be described as a master of rewrite. To the delight of Blockbuster shareholders, the company responded immediately, showing improvement in its bottom line last quarter and predicting a profit, lo and behold, in 2008. Now, two major reasons for the turnaround were cost-cutting moves on the part of the new boss and the collapse of the nation's number two video rental chain, Movie Gallery. And Blockbuster may get a leg up from the recession, because while an economic downturn may be bad for movie theaters, it's typically good for video rentals. Having said all that, Jim Keys is clearly a man with a plan for the future. And as Hollywood struggles with its digital future, this outsider from the world of hot dogs and Slurpees may have some of the answers. Jim, welcome to the business.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what did your consigliere tell you when you took this job? Why did you take it?
Well, as you can imagine, the responses were across the board, from those who thought I should take a little time off and just relax to those who questioned my judgment in taking on such a challenging company and a challenging industry. But actually, those who were closest to me really were not surprised at all.
Mm-hmm.
If I learned one thing in my business career have a skill, I would say it was being able to embrace change, and here was a company that needed to change. I thought I had something to offer.
So how did Blockbuster get to be where it was when you got there? I mean, for people who don't know the company that well, stock price was maybe a fifth of what it had been, lost $85 million last year, lost money in 10 of the 11 last years. Why didn't Blockbuster respond more quickly to the changing market over the years, and what made you think you could turn it around?
Well, Blockbuster is in a very dynamic marketplace, and the company did try to change. They actually made some bold moves, eliminating late fees, introducing total access, subscription DVDs by mail with free exchanges in the stores. So the company really can't be faulted for trying to keep pace with customers' change, but with every strategy comes three essential steps following that strategy, and one is execution, second is verification of results, and third is modification of those plans as necessary. So in our case, I think the verification of results came a bit late, and we heavily invested in some of these programs, didn't modify the programs as necessary, and the company found itself in a financial bind.
So what did you learn at 7-Eleven that's helped with Blockbuster?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting parallel because when I first joined 7-Eleven, over 20 years ago, their demise was also being predicted because of the huge influx of competitors from Exxon to Walmart, all offering convenience at lower prices. But I turned to the CEO, Jerry Thompson, whose father was the founder of 7-Eleven over 80 years ago, and he actually passed along his father's words and said, "Jim, convenience will never die. Products and services will come and go, but customers will always need convenience. And your job is to deliver what they want, when and where they want it." Interestingly, if you look at the entertainment marketplace, which Blockbuster is in, it's all about convenience, providing convenient access to media entertainment. So I think that's a terrific opportunity for Blockbuster to find ways to become more relevant and more convenient to the customer.
Now, the number two movie rental chain, Movie Gallery, recently went bankrupt. And I'm wondering, were its sins the same as Blockbuster's?
The entire industry has been challenged for quite some time. The natural response to an industry that is under attack from other sources, whether it's new channels or new competitors, is to use price as the vehicle to drive growth. And in this industry, when it's all about convenience and all about small stores and having those stores accessible to the consumer, the lower the price, the more difficult it is to maintain quality. For example, there's a direct trade-off between your ability to have the top new releases in stock and on the shelves on Friday and Saturday night, and the ability to offer a low price for that product. They don't go hand in hand. So when one makes that trade-off and sacrifices availability for lower price, the customer is ultimately affected. And I think we've seen that in the video store business traditionally.
And then you've got an angry customer, because I just came in and I want to see Eddie Murphy in makeup or whatever, and you don't have it.
It is one of the most fundamental elements of retail, being in stock on what the customer wants when they want it. And that is something that the entire industry has seen as a shortcoming, actually, for at least the last 10 years.
So what are the lessons of Movie Gallery's near-death experience for Blockbuster?
Well, the key, we think, for the store itself is to constantly change and to focus on the fundamentals. That most important fundamental, as I mentioned, being in stock on the new releases when the customer wants it. And in addition to that, we have to be able to find ways to challenge that customer and to offer them new and different ways to find media entertainment in the store. That could be through alternative content, exclusive opportunities, or even to provide other forms of media entertainment in the form of books or magazines or even music.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jim Keys, the chairman and CEO of Blockbuster. He took over the embattled video chain in July of last year and seems to have stopped the bleeding. So that's what you want to do going forward. But I mean, what did you do on day one when you walked in the door? What was the first order of business for you?
The very first order of business was to correct the financial matters of the company. In fact, the first week of my joining the company, they announced that they had missed a bank covenant for the second quarter. So we had some severe economic challenges that needed to be corrected.
Just so people understand, a bank covenant is basically you missed a bill, basically, right? I mean, that's sort of dealing with creditors. That's job one, right?
Well, it's a promise, if you will, with your lenders to be able to meet certain earnings expectations. Of course, no different from applying for a mortgage and having certain expectations that your bank would have when they lend you that mortgage, and missing the promise that we made to our bankers. Now, it's a very severe situation that was able to be corrected. We, of course, were able to immediately put programs in place that reversed that financial trend. We achieved our covenants for both the third and the fourth quarters of last year and are in much better financial shape going forward. In fact, we just put out new guidance for next year that projects a return to profitability for Blockbuster.
So how did you sort of put the fires out and get the house in order?
Well, there were two immediate changes that needed to be made. The first was to address the cost structure of the company and to identify every unnecessary expense, of course, and to eliminate those expenses to begin to save money.
And by expenses, you mean stores. You shut down an awful lot of them, didn't you?
We had some approximately 250 store closings during the year last year. And interestingly, it's not about just eliminating costs, it's redeploying costs. So we found that labor in the stores was too thin. We actually had too few people on Saturday night to be able to wait on all of our customers. So we were able to redeploy costs by eliminating some positions in some areas of the company and putting more labor actually into the stores, at the same time bringing more savings to the bottom line.
Now, you've cut costs a lot. What's the strategy for growth?
The growth strategy really comes down to three fundamentals. First is to rebuild the core DVD rental business. We think that the DVD rental business is actually quite robust, and with the introduction of Blu-ray and by doing a better job of filling the shelves with top new releases, we think we can do a better job and develop the core rental business into a profitably growing segment for us. Secondly, we plan to focus on retail. We have never really sold very much in the stores. In fact, if you wanted to buy a copy of Shrek for your five-year-old, you might have had to go to one of the other retailers. Today, we are doing a much better job on the retail side and plan to expand those retail offerings to offer not only movies and games, but also game consoles and eventually other related entertainment products and services. And then the third strategy is to develop the emerging digital marketplace. We, very early in my tenure here at Blockbuster, had the good fortune to buy a company called MovieLink, which was one of the first of the digital entertainment companies. So we now have over 6,000 titles in digital format that we're able to rent or sell to our customers via Blockbuster.com, and we'll be able to participate in Blockbuster in a very different form going forward, providing digital content for either portable devices, your PC, or eventually being able to move digital content directly to your television at home.
After a short break, more with Jim Keyes. The new CEO is trying to keep Blockbuster from going bust. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Jim Keyes took the helm of troubled video giant Blockbuster last summer and seems to have stopped the bleeding. But will the patient live? I want to ask you, who's your biggest competitor today? Because you're describing a company that's changing in many ways into Best Buy. It is a company that's turning into a a 7-Eleven and turning into a, sort of a video game store. So, I mean, who is your biggest competitor today?
Well, interestingly, our competitor is not the corner video store that once was, whether it was Hollywood Video or Movie Gallery. And contrary to the belief that many people have today, Netflix is not our largest competitor. They compete with us on about 6% of our core business. But our largest competitor is probably Walmart or Best Buy, those who are in a much broader arena for offering convenient access to media entertainment.
So who do you see as your competition, say, 5 years from now?
5 years from now, it is more likely that some of the large telecom companies or cable companies or perhaps an Amazon would be the more direct competitor for Blockbuster as we evolve into more digital content and the ability to take our content directly to your home. On the other hand, Blockbuster will always have a competitive advantage in our footprint of some 5,000 stores across the country. So the opportunity to have electronic distribution as well as physical distribution, we think, is a very unique characteristic of Blockbuster. And, you know, frankly, it's one of the things that attracted me to this business.
Might it be easier to just restart with a new brand rather than rebrand a company so identified with an old model?
One of the unique opportunities that Blockbuster has, and one of the things that attracted me to the company, was that it is a brand known all over the world for media entertainment. My challenge in many ways is the same challenge that we have seen Coca-Cola go through over the years, or even Apple more recently, in redefining the brand so that it means more for the consumer. Apple was successfully able to redefine themselves from a computer hardware maker, PC maker, into an entertainment provider through the iPod and even a retailer through the Apple stores. And Blockbuster has that same opportunity. It's a very powerful brand, and building a brand with the kind of recognition that we have all over the world can take decades. We have that advantage to start. So our unique opportunity is to make this brand mean more to the consumer, make it more relevant, and I believe that we can transform the brand by transforming the relevance to the customer and the way we reach out to them for their daily lives.
It seems like part of your job is resetting people's idea of what Blockbuster is and what investors can expect from Blockbuster. Do you think you can get Blockbuster's stock back up to where it once was?
I am confident that the company has a very bright future. In fact, the irony is I find it easier to change the customer's expectations than I do the shareholder's expectations. The customer is very resilient. If you're able to transform the environment and put new products and services in front of those customers, they tend to respond very quickly, and we're already seeing that in the stores. In fact, we had very favorable same-store sales results worldwide for the fourth quarter of last year, for the first time in quite some time. The customer response ultimately will lead to the shareholder response, because it will begin to reflect in our same-store growth numbers, our subscription growth numbers, and then ultimately in our earnings, which will translate into higher shareholder value. So I have to be patient, and I hope our shareholders continue to be patient as we reposition this business for a bigger and brighter future.
So last important question.
Sure.
You're going to keep the blue shirts?
There are a couple of changes in the stores that are pretty dramatic. We're losing the yellow walls, and we're losing the blue shirts. The store staff has spoken. And, yeah, we're transforming the look and feel. We actually have a renovation project going on inside of our stores called Rock the Block. And I think you'll see some, you know, very inexpensive changes to the cosmetic look and feel of Blockbuster stores going forward. So far, the customers and the employees have responded in a great way, and it's a lot of fun. It's a fun new environment.
Well, Jim Keys is the chairman and CEO of Blockbuster, maybe Blockbuster Media, soon to be. He joined us from his office in Dallas. Jim, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
We finish our show with commentary from writer and producer Rob Long.
True story. A writer in his late 50s who hadn't worked in a long, long time, but who at one point was very well paid and in demand, found himself facing what we'll call a typical Hollywood career ending number 3. Private school and college tuitions paid, barely, 401k plan, ransacked, home equity, tapped, savings dwindling, cars, one, supermarket, Ralph's, area code, 661. Look it up. It's Palmdale. So with a month or two left before the house goes back to IndyMac and he starts to put baggies on the hands and heads off to Quiznos to make the subs, he calls his old agent and lays it out. Anything, man? Anything at all for me? Now, I promise, this story has a happy ending. Sort of. Now, his agent, who's represented him for almost 30 years, has in that time gone from young guy right out of the mailroom to major player in the business. And like a lot of agents, he's sentimental about his longtime clients, in that he still takes his phone calls. I don't know what I can do for you, he says to his old client. Most of the people in the business now have never even heard of you. It's been a long time. Also, you know, I only work about 2 days a week now. Let me put you in touch with one of our young guys here. So the old agent calls in his assistant and says, look, do something for this guy. I don't know how. He actually isn't very good, never was, but do something. And if it works, I'll make you an agent. So the young assistant calls the old writer in for a meeting. Bring everything, he says, every script, every idea, every notion, everything. Bring it all in, which the writer does in a giant carton. Remember, it's 30 years worth of material. And the assistant sifts through the piles and, you know, it's all pretty bad, but the assistant discovers an old spec feature script of the writer's never sold that's basically a version of a script that was just bought by a major studio and which is on the fast track to production. Now, the young assistant knows that that studio will pay a lot for the script just to take it off the market, just so no other studio beats them to theaters with a similar project. So the assistant then calls all of the studios, ostensibly for his boss, and tells them this. A veteran client of the agency, a guy rich and retired, an artist, has written a wonderful feature script. And then he tells them the basic premise of the script and to expect it by messenger on Friday and to be prepared to make an offer on Monday morning. Now, the studio with the similar project instantly freaks and offers script unread a lot of money to take it off the market. No deal, says the assistant, pretending to speak for his boss. Our client is a veteran. He's an elder statesman. He's too rich to let you buy his script and bury it. I mean, this guy is not motivated by money. So they offer more money, a lot more, and an additional two-script deal besides. And suddenly, the old writer is motivated by money. And that's the happy ending. The assistant is promoted to agent. The writer gets to keep his house and health care. Everybody wins. All right, I'll tell you the real ending of the story. The writer does take the money, but he forgets the second part, which is the and run part. He takes the money and stays. He moves back to the 310 from the 661. He gets the BMW 7 Series. He hires an assistant. He interprets his last-minute save, third act, Deus Ex Machina, one-time-only get-out-of-jail-free card as his comeback. And he's spent the past 2 years and most of the money trying to do just that. I don't know, maybe it'll work. It all depends on how resourceful and aggressive his agent's assistant is. True story.
Writer and producer, Rob Long. And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Bredesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.